Could new security threats change the business of air cargo?
And what are the economic stakes of tomorrow's elections?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, November 1st. Coming up, why the midterm elections matter, not just from a political perspective. And now you can call someone near the peak of Mount Everest. We only hope you can get a signal at home. Mm.
But first, British and German leaders met today to talk about the terror threat that involves air cargo. That's after mail bombs were sent from Yemen last week and traveled through London airports. Now, the cargo industry continues to respond, and we could see some big changes in the way we ship things around the world. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
If air cargo is scanned before loading, and most of it isn't, it'll be scanned by conventional X-ray. But that technology is not very good at detecting small amounts of explosives, as in this case. Security analysts say we should be using the far more sophisticated equipment currently used to scan passengers' checked baggage. But there are two problems with this. That equipment is much more expensive than X-ray machines, and at the moment it will only work on small items of freight. Norman Shanks is a security consultant who helped develop the newer technology, and he says it won't work on whole containers of cargo.
So we have to break them down into individual packages. Take time, it will be costly, but I think we have to introduce that for packages coming from known risks, whether they're either people or from particular countries.
Most countries say the shipping companies and the airlines should bear that extra cost, and they'll undoubtedly pass it on to their customers. Air freight just got more expensive. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We know the midterm elections are sure to have political repercussions, but they'll also spell change for the nation's economic policies. Let's talk with Julia Coronado about that. She's senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas in New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first off, we just got some numbers in from the Commerce Department on personal incomes and spending. The headline is that incomes are down for the first time in more than a year, and spending has also fallen. What does that say to you in terms of the economic health of the average consumer?
Well, I think it just highlights how difficult this recovery is for consumers. While we got a reasonable number on consumer spending growth for the third quarter in the GDP report on Friday, really there's not a lot of wage and salary growth for consumers because the labor market is weak, and they're also starting to lose unemployment benefits. So it's a difficult road for consumers.
All right. And Julia, secondly, the election tomorrow, obviously, political observers are expecting Republicans to make some big gains, especially in the House of Representatives. How is the business community feeling about that?
Well, in general, I think investors and businesses are looking towards the election, the expected outcome of the Republicans taking control of the House and probably not quite the Senate. And basically, getting a more divided government is viewed as a positive by investors and businesses. In fact, the fewer big initiatives that change cost structures and increase tax liabilities, the better from their point of view. But the real big issue for markets this week will be the Fed meeting. It starts tomorrow. We get an announcement on Wednesday, and they're expected to announce a big expansion in monetary policy, which will really be the driver of markets over the next 6 months.
Okay. Julia Coronado, senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
This past Halloween weekend, Americans laid out substantially more than last year to deck themselves out. And it's perhaps no surprise that there were plenty of economic and political get-ups as well. From Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
While most retail's been in the doldrums, Halloween bucked the trend this year, with sales up nearly 4%. And more costumes than ever went to grown-ups, says retail analyst Nicoletta Panteva at Ibis World.
Especially during a time when all we're worrying about is our finances and are we going to have a job tomorrow, it's just kind of a nice relief, even for the adults.
Americans spent more than $2 billion on costumes alone, and some of those played off the country's economic woes and upcoming midterm elections. On Halloween, the group Trick or Vote sent thousands of progressive activists door-to-door in costume. Noah Monger and Mariana Lindsay of Portland described their get-ups.
Throwing on some green jeans, a green turtleneck, and walking around with an iPad all night, and I'm going to go as Green Jobs. So I'm going to be dressing up in Gap-branded clothing, get my cheerleading costume, mix that in, and go as the enthusiasm Gap.
There's certainly plenty of enthusiasm on the other side of the political spectrum. Rick Haven decked himself out as a revolutionary patriot for a Get Out the Vote event near Jacksonville, Florida this weekend.
The men's waistcoat, very ornate, very stylish.
Haven's an expert tailor and costume maker, as well as a local Tea Party official. He says he sold dozens of revolutionary outfits.
By the time you do the uniform and the shirt and the socks and the hat and the last guy wanted a cape, we're well over $1,000. So this isn't something cheap.
Talk about wearing your politics on your sleeve. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, November 1st. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis for the latest look at the markets. Check out our website, marketplace.org, and go right there to the numbers section. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us in the United States. Brazil has elected its first female president. And come the first of the year, political newcomer Dilma Rousseff will take the reins of one of the world's fastest-growing economies. The BBC's Paola Cabral joins us from Sao Paulo with a story. Hi, Paola.
Hello, Steve.
How economically significant is Rousseff's election for the United States and the rest of the world, for that matter?
Well, actually, it's as significant as the fact that Lula da Silva, one of the most popular presidents in the world, the man, as Barack Obama has said once, is leaving now the presidency of this country. And actually, Dilma Rousseff has promised to continue the work of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and he has brought quite a lot of economic growth to Brazil over the last 8 years. You know, Dilma Rousseff was Lula da Silva's chief of staff, and among her main duties was to take care of Brazilian infrastructure, of development of this Brazilian infrastructure. So that is an issue which is extremely important right now in Brazil, and that she's very much across it. So that could be one of her main tasks.
Now she's a former leftist militant. Do we know how that's going to influence her economic policies?
Actually, Dilma Rousseff could be described more as a pragmatic developmentalist and, of course, leftist in the sense that she supports a strong presence of the state in the economy, strong regulation and strong social policies, universal health care, all of these kinds of things. But most of all, she wants Brazil to do business with the rest of the world within terms that would be positive for the country.
The BBC's Paola Cabral joining us from Sao Paulo. Paola, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Here at home, we officially say goodbye to the Pontiac car nameplate. Last night was the expiration date for contracts between parent company General Motors and Pontiac dealers. It's been a slow death for the brand after 84 years. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on the Pontiac beat this morning, and he joins us from Washington with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, we knew this was coming. Remind us why Pontiac is going away.
Well, last year, as a condition of GM's bailout with the government, it had to shed four brands. So out went Pontiac, along with Saab and Saturn and Hummer. The last Pontiac vehicle rolled off the line about 11 months ago, just outside Detroit, Jeremy.
And Pontiac, Scott, used to embody the American muscle car. What happened to that brand?
Well, in the 1960s, Pontiac was America's number three brand behind Chevy and Ford. There was the Pontiac GTO with a huge engine and wide wheelbase. And then, of course, the Trans Am, Burt Reynolds' co-star in Smokey and the Bandit, and its descendant was known as Kit, the star of that TV show Knight Rider. But the oil shocks of the 70s and the new mileage rules changed the auto industry to more fuel-sipping cars. I spoke this morning to Peter Wells at Cardiff University in the UK about the 1970s macho car era.
I mean, in those days, Americans didn't care how much petrol they burned on the way from A to B and were happy to kind of celebrate those big engines. And so in many respects, the muscle car is, well, like rock and roll, a part of our history.
As for the future of the company, Jeremy, Pontiac warranties will still be serviced by GM facilities. As for the company, its future will be embodied by the plug-in Chevy Volt, which we expect next month.
Okay, Marketplace's Scott Tong in Washington. Thanks.
You're welcome.
State attorneys general are now involved in the federal investigation of foreclosures. Allegations include misfiling paperwork and using questionable methods to speed up the foreclosure process. Fortune magazine's Alan Sloan says the mess highlights a double standard between banks and mortgage holders. And he says so many suspect foreclosures are a threat to the financial system and even capitalism as we know it. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
A threat to capitalism. I mean, come on.
No, absolutely. People are catching on that there's a double standard. There's one standard for you, and you're supposed to meet all of your obligations. And then there's another standard for the banks, which is they're supposed to meet their obligations, but if they don't, well, that doesn't matter because we'll give them a do-over.
Is this a too-big-to-fail thing, Alan? I mean, is this why the banks are getting these, you know, slaps on the wrist or do-overs?
I think that's a big part of it because many of the banks involved in this, they're so big that if they in the end had to show out billions or tens of billions, which is theoretically possible, they'd never be able to do it. We'd have to bail them out again, and no one's going to let them fail.
Are people, and by people I mean the ones whose houses are not being foreclosed upon, I mean, seeing what you say is going on?
I think so. When people meet their obligations, which they're legally supposed to do, you expect the banks to meet their obligations, which apparently many of them are not doing.
Then why don't we see legislation, Alan, with people starting to realize this double standard, as you call it? Why don't we see people rising up to say, we need to break up the banks. We need to make them less of a risk to the financial system and end this double standard?
Well, what you see in the election campaigns for the elections tomorrow is you see all of these demands for ending the Fed or ending all bailouts or ending this or ending that, which is never going to happen. The idea that you have to change the rules and break up some of the big institutions that are too big to fail and change the incentives, this is a little subtle, and it doesn't fit in a three-second soundbite, which is why you're not hearing it now.
We'll find out what happens after Election Day, which is tomorrow. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan. Alan, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
Now this item from today's New York Post. A woman from Monroe, Michigan, who wrote to President Obama about her financial troubles, is selling the handwritten response he sent back to her. She's selling it. His note said things will get better. Well, Jennifer Klein will sell the letter to an autograph dealer for $7,000. She says she needs the money to pay off medical bills and to make a down payment on a house.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, the 1st of November. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Steve, the weather can be pretty unpredictable in Chicago.
I know, Jeremy. I spent my childhood near there, and I know how tumultuous everything can be.
Well, starting today, that's going to add to the excitement of the futures market at the Mercantile Exchange, where investors will be able to throw some money down and either wash in profits or just get all wet.
Mm.
From Chicago Public Radio, Tony Arnold reports.
The Chicago Mercantile Exchange is known for selling agricultural commodities and futures, things like corn, wheat, and hogs. But starting today, there's a new game in town, rain. Anyone can now bet on a rainy day, literally. Tim Andreessen is with the Mercantile Exchange.
There's really no science or art in terms of long-term forecast. So, you know, that uncertainty is actually what makes an opportunity for products like this.
Andreessen says any business affected by weather, from farms to concert venues, could find rain futures beneficial. If that concert is rained out, the organization running the show could still make money. The Mercantile Exchange already sells futures for temperature, frost, snow, even hurricanes.
There's just about nothing that you can't make money from anymore if you really want to.
Gilbert Sabensti is a meteorologist at Northern Illinois University, but he doesn't plan to start buying rain futures. He says even weathermen can't predict the weather months in advance. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold for Marketplace.
Alcohol is more harmful to society than the illegal drugs cocaine and heroin. Those other illegal drugs are more harmful to the user. But the key difference in this study is alcoholism's effect on people around the addict and the economic repercussions. The research was done by the former UK drug czar at the Center for Crime and Justice Studies and published in the journal Lancet. Susan Foster is vice president and director of policy research and analysis at the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse, CASA, at Columbia University. She's with us live from New York. Susan, thanks for being here.
I'm happy to join you.
All right. Is this a surprise to you, this study?
It's not a surprise at all. There's been a lot of research in the United States. We've done some of it that shows if you look at overall cost to society, the costs linked to alcohol outstrip those of even tobacco and of all other drugs combined. And our own work on the cost to governments, federal, state, and local government, shows the same pattern.
Put the law enforcement aspect of this aside, how much harder is it to deal with alcoholism as opposed to illegal drug addiction from a cost perspective? I mean, you mentioned how much it costs, but I mean, from an economic perspective as a whole.
Well, the problem is that these costs largely mount as a result of our failure to prevent and treat the problem. We haven't yet learned that we can address this thing by looking for the problem up front and then responding in ways that minimize those costs. So they all mount and they end up that we're paying these back-end costs to shovel up after the problem rather than to invest in prevention and treatment.
What do you think society needs to do to combat this and to lessen the economic costs of alcoholism?
Well, I think they have to understand that alcohol, just as addiction to any other drug, is a medical condition, and that risky use of any of these substances is a public health problem. Until we make that switch away from a sort of criminal justice approach or approach of people behaving badly to base our approach on the science and deal with it as a public health and medical problem, we're not going to solve it. Once we do that, we can significantly eat into and avoid those social costs.
Susan Foster from CASA over at Columbia University. Susan, thank you.
You're welcome.
And finally, cellular phone service has made it to the top of Mount Everest. A big telecom company in Nepal has added 3G coverage right next to the top of the world's tallest peak.
Yeah, Jeremy, it's a big coup, right, to get cell
sure.
service up there so climbers can keep in touch with their families and call rescuers if they need help, if they get into trouble
yep.
over there. So kudos to the fact that there's reliable cell service near Mount Everest. But I wonder when it's going to arrive in downtown Los Angeles.
Or, you know, New York or Chicago or Washington or anywhere else where, you know, people are. But I'm glad that the three people on the peak of Mount Everest will be able to make calls to whoever they want.
In beautiful Los Angeles, which is, I think, 400 feet above sea level, where my phone has 3 bars now, Jeremy.
Well, and I think I only have 2 bars
oh,
right now.
Two.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.